This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Education as a Force for Social Change. Lecture 2 is given in Dornach, August 10th, 1919. If you want to understand the task of anthroposophy in the present and in the near future, then you must consider the nature of human development since the middle of the 15th century, as we did some time ago and then again yesterday. In the end, everything that occurs in the present depends upon the motive that has lived within humanity since the middle of the 15th century. Since that time, human beings have been driven to become complete personalities by placing their individuality in the foreground. In the earlier post-Atlantean developmental periods, this was not possible, nor was it the task of humanity. If you want to understand the significance of that change of direction in which we now stand, then you must look at things in more detail than I did yesterday. In our cultural life, our souls still have a Greek attitude. The manner in which we form our thoughts, the way we customarily think about the world, is actually an echo of the Greek soul. The customary manner of looking at rites and everything connected with them is an echo of the Roman soul. In our government, we still see a structure that is basically that of the Roman Empire. Only when we can see that the threefold social organism must break in upon our modern chaos, will we be able to understand clearly and act decisively. We can characterize the Greek soul primarily as the attitude predominant in Greece and in historical development until the middle of the 15th century. A subjugated people and their conquerors lived throughout the Greek territories. The conquerors occupied the land and, through their bloodline, determined the spirituality of ancient Greece. You can, therefore, never fully comprehend the attitude of the ancient Greeks if you do not recognize that when people saw the social interactions that resulted from the peculiarities of the Aryan conqueror's blood as proper. Let me read that again. You see, you can therefore never fully comprehend the attitude of the ancient Greeks if you do not recognize that then people saw the social interactions that resulted from the peculiarities of the Aryan conqueror's blood as proper. Of course, modern humanity has grown beyond what was basic for the Greeks. For them, it was obvious that there were two kinds of people, namely people who worshipped Mercury and people who worshipped Zeus. These two classes of people were strictly separated. However, everyone thought about the world and their gods in the way that the conquerors, due to their blood characteristics, did of necessity. Everything resulted from the clash of the conquered and the conqueror. If you look more closely at what lives in people in our modern society, you will see that those things living in our feelings and subconsciously in our souls no longer accept that aristocratic view of the world. However, the aristocratic worldview still lives in our ideas and concepts, particularly if we have been educated at one of the secondary schools. The higher schools, in particular the classical high schools, educate so that everything is only a renaissance or echo of ancient Greek culture. With the exception of the technical and agricultural colleges, this is even more true of our institutions of higher education. Technical and agricultural colleges arose out of modern life, but unfortunately they were patterned after higher education in ancient Greece, at least in their outer structure. If you highly value the culture of ancient Greece in its time and for its time, you must be clear that a renewal of cultural life is necessary now. You must recognize how increasingly intolerable it is to have humanity led by people whose souls have received their configuration of concepts through our modern classical education. In all leading positions today, we find only people who have been educated in our modern classical secondary schools. we need to recognize that a time of major change, not of minor reformation, is at hand, and we must think about such things objectively and not cling to our own habitual thoughts. You know, of course, that what formed from the blood in ancient Greece became abstract in ancient Rome. I have already mentioned that. Although the Greek social structure, we cannot call it a government, arose strictly from bloodlines, this did not continue with the Romans. In Rome, the desire for the Greek organization continued, but the Romans no longer felt the basis of this organization in the blood. It would never have occurred to the ancient Greeks to doubt that there were lesser people, the conquered, and higher people, the Aryans. That was no longer true for the Romans. In the Roman Empire, people carried a strong consciousness that power and force determined the division of society. You need only recall that the Romans traced their origins back to that band of thieves called together to found Rome. You know that the founders of Rome were not nursed by their mother, but by a wolf in the forest. All these things were integrated into the Roman nature and resulted in the Romans dividing society more according to abstract concepts. Thus, our legal and governmental concepts resulted from the Roman disposition. In this connection, I'm often reminded of an old friend. I met him when he was already quite old. In his youth, at the age of 18, he fell in love with a girl, and they became secretly engaged. But neither of them had any money, so they could not marry. They waited and remained true to one another. He was 18 years old at the time he became engaged, and before he could consider marrying, he was 64. Only then had he saved enough money to believe he could dare take such a step. He went back to his hometown near Salzburg and wanted to marry the one he chose so long ago. When he arrived, he saw that the church and rectory had burned, and he could no longer obtain his baptismal certificate. His baptism was no longer registered, so no one believed he had actually been born. I remember quite well when his letter came. At that time I lived near Vienna. In his letter he told me, quote, "I think it is quite evident that I was born, because here I am, but people do not believe that I was born, because I don't have a baptism certificate," unquote. I once had a discussion with a lawyer who told me that in a legal proceeding it is not at all important whether the person is present or not. All that is necessary is the birth certificate. You never forget such stories, because they are so absurd. Nevertheless, the ideas these stories exemplify show that the basis of our entire public and legal life, to a greater or lesser extent, is what existed in ancient Rome. How true it is that today you are not a citizen of the world simply because you are a human being and exist, but because you are properly registered. We can trace all such things back to ancient Rome. Blood lineage changed into official registration. Today these things are degenerating, with the result that many people believe they have no value as human beings, but only have the value of the official position they hold, or of this or that official designation. People would rather be an impersonal Roman legal concept than an individual personality. Since the middle of the 15th century, an unconscious or subconscious desire has existed to center everything around the individual. We can see this in the fact that the time is ripe for a renewal of both our cultural and our rights life, and that we need a true renewal. This is connected with the need for a renewal of human souls, and with many tendencies lying deep within human development. Consider how the scientific way of thinking, particularly when based upon abstract natural laws and sense perception, and upon the thoughts created from that perception, has affected the cognitive aspect of human development since the middle of the 15th century. People accept nothing except what arises out of sense perception and the thoughts connected with it. I reminded you yesterday that there are certainly enough modern people who hold the correct opinion, namely that such a view of nature leads us only to a phantom picture of nature. The picture of the world created by natural scientists is a phantom and not the real world. Since the middle of the 15th century, humanity is capable of making a phantom picture of the world, at least regarding half of it. For initiation science, something is hidden deep behind this that we must now consider. We cannot change our sense perceptions, and it is basically unimportant for a deeper view of the world whether we see them as Maya or as something else. We cannot change sense perceptions. They are what they are. A red flower is a red flower, regardless of whether we view it as Maya or as reality. It is what it is. All sense perceptions are what they are. The real discussion begins only when we create thoughts about sense perceptions, that is, when we view sense perceptions as being this or that, or interpret them as this or that. That is where the difficulties begin. Why do they begin there? They begin there because the concepts that we as human beings have created since the 15th century are different from earlier human concepts. Modern history is actually a fable convenue, a convenient story, and does not correctly consider that at all. Those who have had an opportunity to study human concepts before the middle of the 15th century know that those concepts were filled with a pictorial quality, that they were actually living pictures. The abstract quality of concepts has been present in its current form only since the middle of the 15th century. Why has humanity developed such that since the middle of the 15th century we have abstract concepts, concepts we are so proud of and are so emotional about? Why do we, humanity as a whole, develop such abstract concepts? The abstract concepts created by humanity have the peculiarity that although we apply them to the sense-perceptible world, they are not really applicable there. They are worthless for the sense-perceptible world. I spoke about this in my book titled The Riddles of Philosophy. There I said that the way people create cognitive concepts about the outer world is a side effect of human soul development. Imagine a seed of grain in the earth that is predestined by nature to become a plant. We grind many grain seeds to make flour, and then eat them as bread. However, that is not inherent in the grain seed. It is unrelated to the nature of grain if we ask whether the grain contains those chemical elements we need to maintain our bodies. It is not in the nature or essence of grains of wheat or rye to feed us, but only to produce new wheat or rye plants. In the same way, it does not lie in our nature to grasp the outer world through those concepts we have learned since the middle of the 15th century. Rather, we need to learn something else from those concepts if we are to enter properly into their true nature. The concepts people have developed since the middle of the 15th century are shadows of our experiences in the spiritual worlds before conception. Allow me to draw this so that you can better picture it, Rudolf Steiner now draws and describes. Here is birth, and human life goes in this direction. When you imagine it that way, our concepts and power to conceptualize are only echoes of our experiences before birth. We misuse our conceptual capacity when we apply it to the sense-perceptible world. That is the foundation of the Goethean understanding of nature. Goethe did not want to express natural laws through concepts. He wanted to understand archetypal phenomena, that is, he wanted a synthesis of external perceptions, because he had a feeling that we cannot directly apply our ability to create concepts to nature. We must develop our ability to form concepts as pure thinking. If we do that, they point toward our prenatal spiritual existence. We have our modern way of thinking to reach, through pure thinking, our spiritual essence as it existed before we were clothed with a physical body. The real task of the fifth post-Atlantean period will not have entered human souls until humanity comprehends that we think in order to comprehend ourselves as spiritual beings. In a certain sense, natural science was forced into human fate so we would remain with pure nature. That is, so that we would not speculate about it, but use our conceptual thinking to see nature in the proper way. We need to develop our conceptual thinking to see how we were spiritually before we were clothed with a physical body at birth. Today, people believe they should use their conceptual thinking simply to classify external sense perceptions. They will act correctly, though, only when they apply the thoughts they have had since the middle of the 15th century to the spiritual world, where they were before they were clothed with a physical body. That is how people of the 5th post-Atlantean period are forced toward the spiritual and prenatal life. Through yet another thing, people come into a peculiar situation that they must develop further. Parallel to the natural scientific phantom is that of industrialism. I mentioned this yesterday. A major characteristic of industrialism is that machines, the actual bearers of industrialism, are spiritually transparent. There is nothing in them we cannot comprehend. Yesterday I mentioned that even minerals preserve something that is not transparent, but machines are perfectly transparent. The result is that when we direct human will toward machines, we do not, in truth, direct it toward reality. The machine is basically a chimera of comprehensive world reality. Industrialism brings something into human life that makes the will meaningless in a higher sense. A major change will occur when modern people finally become completely convinced that the machine and everything connected with it and with industrialism makes human will meaningless. Today we are at the peak of mechanical efficiency. Machine power, not human will, now produces a quarter of everything made on earth. A quarter of everything. That is something extraordinary. Human will no longer has a reason for living on earth. When you read things like the speeches of Rabindranath Tagore, you must actually feel something in them that remains unintelligible for a European using normal European intellect and reasoning. A different basic tone exists in the things a modern educated Asian says, because the European spirit's accustomed familiarity with the machine is something unintelligible and senseless for an educated Asian. The effects of machinery and industrialism are meaningless to an Oriental. Another thing is just as senseless to an Oriental, whether we in Europe believe it or not, and that is the European politics of the machine age. The Oriental can make no sense of that either. When educated Orientals speak, they express their feeling that a quarter of all human work now done is senseless. People educated in the traditional Oriental manner do not do this. Only those more directed toward the West and their imitators, the Japanese and so forth. Since modern educated Orientals have a higher degree of atavistic clairvoyance, they recognize that everything people put into machines as work has a very particular characteristic. When someone plows the field with a horse and plow, working with the horse, the work with the horse still contains some natural forces and some significance beyond the present. That work has a universal significance. When a wasp builds a nest, this structure has cosmic meaning. If someone starts a fire by striking flint against a stone, causing sparks to fly that then ignite the tinder, that person exists in unity with nature, and the act has cosmic significance. We have lost our connection to cosmic purpose through modern industrialism. There is no universal consequence when we turn on an electric light. Cosmic meaning is gone. When you go into a modern factory, completely filled with machines, what you find is a cosmic hole, H-O-L-E, something without consequence in cosmic development. If you go into the forest to gather wood, that has some cosmic importance beyond earthly development. If you look at a modern factory with everything it contains, that has no importance beyond earthly development. Human will is misplaced there and has no universal purpose. Think about what that means. Since the middle of the 15th century, we have developed a cognition that is fantastic, distant from reality. We direct more and more of our activity towards serving machines. We carry out more and more of our activity within industry. And the will we put into this industrial activity is meaningless for cosmic evolution. A great question now confronts our souls. Does the fact that our knowledge is, to a large extent, fantastic and our will meaningless have any significance for the totality of human development? Yes, it has significance, extremely important significance. It means that, as human beings, we must forge our way past that fantasy into an understanding of reality, into that understanding of reality that does not stop with nature, but continues on into the spiritual existing beyond nature. As long as people received the spirit along with their concepts, they could neglect to exert themselves to gain the spirit. However, since now only concepts remain, concepts devoid of the spirit, but people still want to reach up to the spirit, many people long to rise above abstract understanding and gain real spiritual understanding. Since we now have industrialism and its lack of meaning, we must seek another meaning for the human will. We can seek that meaning only when we rise to a worldview capable of bringing meaning to what is meaningless, namely to industrialism. We can do that by bringing meaning from the spiritual and recognizing that we are to seek tasks set for us by the spiritual. Earlier, if we wanted something from the spiritual, we did not need to exert ourselves, because instinct connected the spiritual with human will. Today, we must especially exert ourselves to will out of the spirit. We must counter meaningless industrial willing with a meaningful willing out of the spirit. Yesterday, I gave you an example of how we should teach. We need to understand that until the age of 7, children are primarily imitators because they need to develop their physical bodies. Thus, we should make imitation the primary principle of education during that time. We also know that from the age of 7 to 14, children need to develop their etheric bodies through a respected authority. And we should make the knowledge we gain through spiritual cognition the basis of our teaching during that period. Finally, we know that from the age of 14 to 21, children's astral bodies develop, so that we should use that knowledge as the basis of our teaching. Only then can we will out of the spirit. Until the middle of the 15th century, people instinctively willed out of the spirit. In external life, we now will completely to integrate ourselves with the mechanical, with machines. Even in politics, our willing toward the mechanical has slowly made the state into a machine. We need to make an effort toward a spiritually founded willing based upon an acceptance of the idea of spiritual science. For example, in education, we should begin with an understanding of the spiritual world and teach according to the knowledge we gain from anthroposophy. Through a stronger and more conscious emphasis of spiritual willing, we counter the meaningless willing arising from industrialism. We are given industrialism with all the monotony it brings to human beings and human souls, so that we can use that boredom to work toward willing arising from the spirit. In education, we can best begin to will from the spirit if we teach in a manner consistent with what spiritual understanding requires. We must rethink many things today, but to do this we need a carefully developed inner sense of truth. We should be clear that we need to use an inner sense of truth, even though we are unaccustomed to using it, For instance, you would quite astonish many people if you were to say that they were correct in honoring Raphael because of his paintings, but that they would be mistaken in demanding that modern people paint as Raphael did. The only people who have a right to admire Raphael are those who know that only a poor painter would paint in the same manner today, because this would not be painting out of the impulses active in our time. People's feelings are not consistent with the times if they do not deeply feel the need for that consistency. In our time, we need to have an intimate feeling of truth about this way of seeing things. However, modern people tend to go more in the opposite direction in this connection. You slowly gain an impression that this sense of truth has sprung a leak, that it no longer functions properly because people shy away from calling what is right, right, and what is wrong, wrong. They are afraid to call a lie, a lie. We experience all kinds of horrible things in this regard, and worse still, people are oblivious to all the terrible things they experience. The point here is that people need to have such a sense for the truth that they know, for example, that Raphael's style of painting does not belong in the present. We need to view it as something from the past, and thus, also, to admire it as something from the past. Now, we particularly need to pay attention to such things when a desire for truth overcomes us out of the depths of our souls. I often think of a beautiful passage in Hermann Grimm's biography of Michelangelo, where Grimm discusses Michelangelo's title, Last Judgment, where he speaks about how many Last Judgment paintings were made in those times. He also mentions that the people of that time completely experienced the reality of what was painted on the wall. Those people lived in the truth of those paintings of the Last Judgment. Today, we shouldn't even look at a picture like Michelangelo's Last Judgment without being conscious that we do not perceive it in the same way as the people for whom Michelangelo painted it. We should be aware that we have lost that feeling, and that at best we can say it is a painting of something we can no longer directly believe to be reality. Think about someone standing before that painting with today's consciousness, someone who does not think that angels really come down, or that the devil does what Michelangelo depicted in his painting. Such a person views that painting much differently than someone in Michelangelo's time, who saw those pictures as reality. However, just when you become aware that the feelings modern people have when they view the Last Judgment are somewhat abstract and gray, you will be inwardly called upon to empathize with the interwoven pictures within the Last Judgment. Of course, Michelangelo painted during the ebb of the fourth post-Atlantean period. Nevertheless, he painted out of the spirit of that period and stands as a kind of boundary between both. I once discussed that in a lecture on art. You will need to ask yourself how it was that people of that age could look upon such powerful living pictures presented in paintings. The tremendous importance of that question confronts us when we become aware of how drab and lacking in life are the feelings of someone standing before such a picture by Michelangelo today. We must then ask about the cause. Why is it that human souls of that time could see the end of the earth in that way? Where did the composition of these pictures come from? The answer lies in the following. During the first Christian period, that is, since the time the mystery of Golgotha took effect upon the earth's evolution and gave it meaning, much that existed of the old ways had to recede and wait for humanity to later win them back. Among those things was the idea of repeated earthly lives. If we depict life, Rudolf Steiner draws here, all human life flows in this manner. Earthly life, life in the spiritual world, earthly life, life in the spiritual world, and so forth. The content of the ancient atavistic, instinctive view of the world was that the entirety of human life flowed in this manner. The first task of Christianity was to arouse human concepts other than those of ancient wisdom. How did Christianity achieve this? It brought human life into consciousness only from this point forward. See cross in the drawing. That is, from the beginning of the present earthly life. It allowed life before the last death and before birth to be only a thought held by God, not anything connected with human individuality. Before the human being actually became a human being at birth, there existed only the spiritual world, out of which human beings arose as God's thoughts. Then life after death was added. In a sense, during the first Christian period, the focus shifted. Here, life between death and rebirth, then earthly life, then again life between death and rebirth, and so forth. Human perception was limited to looking only toward human origins, and then toward life after death. On the other hand, this resulted in a counterbalance through paintings of the Last Judgment. Paintings of the Last Judgment arose because Christianity first eliminated the principle of pre-existence from human feeling, that is, spiritual existence before conception and birth. Today, the need to recognize repeated earthly lives once again flows from the depths of human souls. For this reason, today those paintings pale that emphasize only one earthly life and the spiritual world before and after it. An intense desire now exists to expand the Christian view of the world from that of earlier times. The mystery of Golgotha affects not only those who assume one earthly life, but is also valid for those who know of repeated earthly lives. We need this expansion now. We should be aware that we live in a time where we should use the chimera of normal conceptualization, the meaninglessness of mechanized willing, to raise ourselves towards spirit cognition and a spiritually permeated willing, and to expand our religious awareness to include repeated earthly lives. People now need to take the full import of this present expansion of human consciousness deep into their souls. The ability to understand how to live in the present and to properly prepare for the future depends upon this. Everyone can use that understanding wherever they may now be in life. Eventually, there will arise out of an external understanding of the human being something that presently only plays in the subconscious depths of the soul, but that will later sound and resound with the weight of full consciousness. The most obvious thing in modern life is the many torn human souls, troubled souls who know nothing about how to do anything with life, asking time and again, "What should I do? What is the meaning of life for me?" They attempt so many things and still are never satisfied. The number of people with such problematic natures increases more and more. Why is that? It arises out of a deficiency in our education. Today we educate children in a way that does not awaken the inner strength that makes human beings fit for life. What makes people strong is that they imitate until the age of 7, and follow admired authority until the age of 14. What makes people strong is that their love is developed in the proper manner until the age of 21. Later, that strength can no longer be developed. What gives people troubled natures is that the forces we must develop in particular stages during youth are not awakened. That is what we must know. That is why I said yesterday that if we want to have a truly social future, we must prepare for that through education. We cannot achieve that through small changes. The necessary changes are great. Our way of educating has slowly become something that prepares only mechanized spirits, vegetized souls, and animalized bodies, as I described yesterday. We may not continue in that direction. We should strongly develop the forces existing in children's souls, so that later human beings can draw upon their childhood development. Today people look back upon childhood, they feel their childhood, but cannot draw anything out of it simply because nothing was developed. We must fundamentally change our principles of education if we are to have any hope of achieving what is right in this question. Right now we must be very skeptical when people enthusiastically promote things, when things are touted as being particularly helpful. children need to learn to concentrate, and we can achieve that not through overwork, but through efficient teaching. We can achieve that in the way modern people need if we eliminate something that is very popular today, namely those cursed class schedules, the death of any genuine development of human strength. Think about what that means. From 7 to 8 arithmetic, from 8 to 9 language, from 9 to 10 geography, 10 to 11 history. Everything that moved the soul from 7 until 8 is erased by what happens from 8 until 9, and so forth. We need to get to the bottom of the problem. We may no longer consider subjects simply as subjects. Instead, we must see that we properly develop thinking, feeling, and willing in children between the ages of 7 and 14. Geography, arithmetic, and so forth should all be used to develop the proper manner of thinking, feeling, and willing. There is much talk among modern educators about how we should develop individual capacities and how we should discover from the child's nature which capacities to develop. Just empty words. Such things can have meaning only when spoken from the standpoint of spiritual science, otherwise they remain just empty talk. In the future, we will need to say that, for instance, at a particular stage of childhood, we should teach arithmetic. During that time, we should use the mornings for 2 or 3 months to teach arithmetic. We do not need a class schedule that mixes everything together. Rather, we need to teach arithmetic for a time, and then go on. We need to bring our teaching into harmony with the needs of human nature at a particular time. Here you can see the tasks of a pedagogy working toward the future. In such questions, incontestable problems confront modern people earnestly considering future social development. However, there is little understanding for them. In Stuttgart, in connection with our social activities, we will create a school to the extent possible within the modern school system. Mr. Molt has decided to form such a school for the children of his workers at the Waldorf Astoria Company. Later, we will also admit a limited number of other children. We will need to take into account the teaching goals now set by the state. We will need to bring the children to a certain level by a particular grade, and we will also need to make compromises. However, we can mix those things demanded by human nature with those things demanded by the state, those clever things so idolized by today's socialists. That is a fact that we must all recognize. Who today would think that the class schedule is the death of all genuine human education? There are people who believe in these class schedules, to whom we would reply that the world is standing on its head, and we must begin to set it on its feet. There are people who now want to shorten the hours and teach a different subject every half hour, one after the other. Many people now consider that to be an ideal. You should just imagine what an impossible kaleidoscopic picture that would present: religion, arithmetic, geography, drawing, singing. It would look just like the colors in a kaleidoscope, all mixed up in the children's heads. It, quote, looks like something, unquote, only for the external world. But there is not the slightest coherence. Modern people simply do not believe that we need to think in broad strokes instead of details, that we need a grand overview, a comprehensive overview. Today we experience time and again that people habitually say, "Yes, we must have a revolution." Even a large portion of narrow-minded conformists believe in the need for revolution. I am not certain if that is the case here, but there are certainly large areas where a majority of the middle class believes in the necessity of revolution. When, however, you approach them with things that I speak of in title Towards Social Renewal, such as the threefold social organism, they say that they do not understand it. It is too complicated. Lichtenberg once said that when a head collides with a book and makes a hollow sound, it is not necessarily the book's fault. It's true, isn't it? Today people don't believe such things, because there is not always a self-recognition of what is most commonly found in people's souls. Nevertheless, you can see that in many areas, even the reactionaries, believe in the need for revolution. But then they say, yeah, yeah, we can't be concerned with such big things and such thoughts. What you need to tell us is how to socialize shoemaking, or how to socialize the pharmacy, how we can do that. You ought to tell us how to sell our spices in a revolutionary state. Slowly you begin to realize what people mean by that. They mean that there must be a revolution. They are in complete agreement with that. But everything should remain as it is, and nothing should be changed. Many people are asking how we can turn everything topsy-turvy and yet not change anything. The people who are most remarkable in this connection are the so-called intellectuals. You can have very strange experiences with them. One thing I have often experienced is that they say, yes, three social realms, an autonomous university, because cultural life should be self-administered. But how are we to live? Who will pay our salaries if the state no longer does? We need to look at these things now. We may no longer simply brush them off. Change is especially necessary in the area of cultural life. The end of Lecture 2.